In lecture, we are about to start amino acids. Amino acids, which means we need to know something about acid-base chemistry. And even once you leave this course, many of you are going to go take biochem, which means you need to be able to operate with the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation and to know its limitations, to know when you could use it and when you can't. Because that lets you do that lets you calculate pH of buffer solutions, which you use in order to force amino acids to be in one form or another. Because we reviewed how there's this cationic, anionic, and zwitterionic forms. There's also the classic experiment of determining the pKa value of an acid, which you can do through titration. And so what we're going to do first is just a short review of acid-base chemistry, to then get us to the point where we can talk about the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, which then we'll take a very short break, and then we'll come back and talk about titration. How can we experimentally get to a pKa value? And that discussion is actually going to dovetail very much with the discussion of the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. So let's just start with the general acid-base review first, and we'll start with, what is an acid? Anything that dissociates to make a proton? Or we have this alternate definition of something being an electron acceptor. So I'm not going to write this down because it's not Chem 1A, but we have the Arrhenius definition, we have the Bronsted-Lowry definition, and we have the Lewis definitions of acids and bases. So the Lewis is the one that, Leonardo, you just referred to last, which has to do with electron pairs. But when we come up with pKa values, we're generally discussing things that do dissociate to make H+, which the broadest definition that covers that conceptualization is the Bronsted-Lowry definition, where an acid is something that generates H+. Now, under that definition, what would a base be then? Something that accepts H+, but that's a broader definition than the one that most of us probably learned first in junior high, chemistry, wherever. What's an even more fundamental definition? That a base is something that explicitly dissociates to make hydroxide. Well, ammonia is a very common base that would fail to be classifiable under that definition, because ammonia does not dissociate to make hydroxide. It will react with water, cause water to make hydroxide, but in the formula NH3, there is no OH. So, but that is, however, where we get our definitions of acids and bases originally. Why? Because the fact that in water, there's always some proportion of H+ and OH- ions in solution. And this is called the auto-ionization of water. Would this auto-ionization actually be something favorable? Would auto-ionization be something that's a favorable process? No, because you're breaking a bond and you're trying to separate out ions. So why does it happen if it's unfavorable? What's that? Equilibrium. That's kind of a good answer. Could you explain that a little bit more, though? Okay, if an equilibrium can happen, it will happen? Yeah, that's an acceptable answer. What's another way to express it not using equilibrium? Well, the Shanley's is still related to equilibrium, though. So there's this graph that you've all seen a bunch of times before, which this is what Emerson's getting at, that if you have some distribution of molecular energies, which I know I didn't label this, but that's because you've seen it a bazillion times, that as you get to, or if you have a barrier that the molecules have to cross for some kind of reaction or process to occur, at any temperature, there'll at least be a few molecules that have that energy to dissociate. let me.
Systems here.
So the auto-ionization of water, which is this, what this is. Is an unfavorable process. That does occur to some degree at any temperature. Since there will always be a fraction of molecules. That have the energy to dissociate. And since Leonardi did bring up the idea of equilibrium, we could say there, yes, is an equilibrium constant for this process, which, as you already probably know, it's called Kw. In this process, since water is declared a liquid, it's a pure substance, it's not given a concentration, even though technically we could take 1,000 grams of water, which at a certain temperature is 1 liter, and calculate that that's equivalent to 55.5 molar. But we leave it out in this expression, we only get the H plus and the OH minus concentrations. And that product has a value of 1.0 times 10 to the negative 14th but only one temperature. And that's critical for what I'm about to show you. Now, in pure water, at this temperature, which I'll look up what the temperature is, because to be honest, I always confuse what temperature water's triple point occurs at versus what temperature does water have exactly a density of 1 versus what temperature does water have exactly a specific heat of 1 versus this temperature where water has exactly this dissociation constant of 1.0 times 10 to negative 14. So I'll look it up, but the point is, at this magical temperature, the hydroxide ion concentration is going to be equal to how much H plus that you have, which if we were to substitute into Kw, it leads us to the fact that the hydrogen ion concentration would be 1.0 times 10 to the negative 7 molar. How? Well, because if the hydride ion concentration is the same as hydroxide, and that's true because you get one molecule breaking up into one of each of these, then if we call H plus X, OH minus is also X, we get X squared equals 1 times 10 to the negative 14, which is how we get X, which is H plus, being equal to 1.0 times 10 to the negative 7. There's then this unit, or this way of measure called pH, which is defined as the negative base 10 log of that H plus concentration, and so it would be equal to 7.00. But, big huge note, pH equals 7 means neutral at only one temperature. Why is this true? Yeah? Almost. It's just rephrasing slightly what you said. The H plus and OH minus concentrations change, and that's because, not necessarily due to intermolecular forces changing, but the fact that more molecules could dissociate. Because if the fact that there's dissociation in the first place is due to molecular energy distribution, then as we increase temperature, we increase the number of molecules that are able to undergo this dissociation, which means you have more H plus and OH minus. So even though you might still have a neutral solution, neutral doesn't have anything to do with pH 7, because pH is just a measure of the H plus concentration. But it just happens to work out, coincidentally, at this right temperature, we get this nice, easy-to-remember number, which is why we are programmed, many of us, to say, oh, neutral means pH 7, but that's garbage. If you think back to your Chem 1B days, if you took it here, if we did a multiple temperature pH experiment, you had to program your probe each time for the temperature to take into account this behavior of water more fully ionizing automatically because of higher temperature. That's what I'm saying. I need to look it up because there's these magic numbers when water does its things, and I never remember which one's 4 degrees and point this degree and whatever degree. So I'll look it up. But somewhere close enough to room temperature, that's why we presume that neutral is pH 7. But I just want to emphasize that it isn't. It just is at that one temperature that pH 7 is neutral. All right. So an acid is something that makes H plus. A base presumably is something that makes OH minus, but now we're going to work with that more expanded definition where we focus on the H plus instead. Because many organic molecules accept an H plus, but don't have hydroxide. So we'll use that broader definition. Now within that kind of definition though, where we're still dealing with H plus, or at the very least if we still say that we're dealing with aqueous solutions, then there's a couple of things that we could write down. For example, we can quantify the likelihood that some particular acid is going to dissociate. Not to be neutralized, but just by itself to dissociate. So using a typical organic example of acetic acid, notice that in this case, acetic acid along with what it turns into, these are all water soluble. And so if we have water as the solvent, all three of these things are going to end up in the equilibrium constant because they are in the same phase. Now, if acetic acid is an acid, then how could we refer to what's produced here, the acetate? What is its relationship to acetic acid? It is its conjugate. And very frequently, for these kinds of processes, we abbreviate. Generally, the A in HA means acid, but this happens coincidentally to be acetate as well. And so using that simplified representation, we could say that the equilibrium constant for that dissociation is H plus concentration times A minus concentration over HA. We could also, though, talk about a Bronsted-Lowry base and what would happen to it in water, which this could be classified as a hydrolysis reaction then. Notice that we again have a mixture of phases here. Again, water being a pure substance, we would ignore in whatever equilibrium constant we could write. But before writing that constant, let's make the same kind of simplification of structure. So B for base, I could say B reacts with water to produce two things, hydroxide and its acid conjugate. So we have a base and its conjugate. And we could write a KB that, again, is products over reactants,
So HB, the conjugate, times hydroxide over B itself.
Now, let's just say, for the sake of argument, that A and B are the same thing. Meaning, for example, I started about acetic acid dissociating, then I switched to talking about ammonia. But what if instead I was talking about acetate, the product of acetic acid, itself reacting in water? Because one of the things we're going to touch on in just a bit is that if we let acetate dissociate completely, that doesn't want to be in that situation because it is something that is in equilibrium. So if you throw acetate by itself in water, sodium acetate, for example, you're going to cause a reverse reaction. So we could put acetate as our base example. So if we make A and B just the same compound, just we're talking about different conjugates, then what happens if we multiply Ka and Kb? Well, that would give us H plus times A minus over HA times OH minus times HB over B. But if I say A and B are the same thing, then A and B cancel, HA and HB cancel, which means we end up with H plus times OH minus, which is KW. Now notice that this definition falls out this way because we're assuming the base reaction occurs in water. Which, let me finish this little idea, and I want to revisit that idea. So on a purely mathematical basis, not understanding physically what's going on, just looking at this expression, we could say an acid's strength which is measured by this Ka. More dissociation, bigger Ka. Dissociation is the strength of an acid. How much does it break apart? An acid's strength is inversely proportional to its conjugate base's strength. Kind of off topic, but something to consider, because we're going to be getting more into pKa values. What is the strongest base that can survive in water? What is the strongest base that can survive in water? What would happen to Grignard in water? No, but answer that. It'll be useful. To give you what, though? Just plain out. Plain, let's say if you took bromobutane, made a Grignard reagent with it, reacted with water, what do you get? Not quite. So remember, Grignards act like really strong bases, correct? So the Grignard would just pull a hydrogen off water, make an alkane. But what's left over? Hydroxide, right? What happens if we reacted sodium borohydride with water? What do we get? Hydroxide. What happens if we take a triple bond, deprotonate it, and throw it in the water? What are we going to make? Hydroxide. Because if water is a weaker acid, no. If water is a stronger acid than all these other compounds you're making bases out of, Grignard reagents, lithium, sodium borohydride, any of those. Then once you add them to water, they react, they neutralize, and all you're left with is hydroxide. So let me ask you this. How can you measure the pKa of something like a triple bond, that carbon-hydrogen bond? It's got a pKa of 25 when nothing can exist in water with a pKa above water's own pKa. How do we measure pKa then? But same thing in reverse then. If we're going to somehow measure pKb, there's only some limit to H plus concentration we can get. There's only some limit of OH minus concentration. And if you had an acid stronger than H plus, it would just react to turn into H plus. And if you had a base stronger than hydroxide, it would just turn into hydroxide. The answer is you can't. You have to use other solvents or other techniques in order to get those pKa values. But I bet you that in whatever you read in your OChem text so far, probably doesn't mention any of that, does it? But it is, for those of you who will go into a more advanced class where they do talk more about acid-base chemistry, then you need to know there are limits of what can exist in aqueous solution because there's limits to what water itself can handle.
So back onto this main track of discussion we were on, though. Since we're talking about acid and base strength, let's make sure we do know what strong and weak mean. So if I have a strong acid, then what's the definition of that?
You have extensive or complete dissociation.
And I'll throw this buzzword in, extensive, spontaneous dissociation. Well, if you dissociate a bunch, that means you have more products than reactants, so your Ka is going to be large. Which means you'll have a small pKa. And remember that pKa has a similar definition as pH. It is the negative base 10 log of the
Ka constant. We often use pKa instead of Ka because it's easier to memorize small numbers with a few digits instead of things like 1.82 times 10 to the negative 23rd. If you're a number junkie, then you might do well with that. Otherwise, most of us humans like pKa numbers. No offense to the number junkies out there. So, HCl is a strong acid, and so we should be able to answer these kinds of questions very quickly.
If I had 1 molar, or 0.1 molar, or centimolar HCl, what would the pH
of a 1 molar HCl solution be? I'm hearing way too many answers. Let me try it again. What would be the pH of a 1 molar solution of hydrochloric acid? Well, what's the definition of pH? The concentration of H plus in solution. Is HCl a strong acid? Yeah, it's got a negative pKa, which means it has 99%+ dissociation. So the assumption we generally make is if you have 1 mole of acid, then it makes 1 mole of H plus. So if we have 1 molar acid, we presume we have 1 molar H plus. And if we have 1 molar H plus, the pH is? Now, you did that with a calculator, didn't you? I'm looking at everybody else in here. You science transfer majors. Log of 1 is?
Zero.
There we go. pH 0.
It might help to remind us all that 1 is 10 to the 0th power.
Log means take the exponent off of the 10. So log of 10 to the 0 is 0.
10th molar HCl, 10 to the negative 1.
Log of 10 to the negative 1 is negative 1. The negative base 10 log of 10 to the negative 1 is therefore 1.
For centimolar, which is 10 to the negative 2, that means it's going to be a pH of 2. Except it's not.
So notice I've put on top of this these approximately equal to designations. I don't remember in real life.
The second one, I wrote the wrong number here. Yeah.
But why do these pH values not come out to be what we expect them to be? You might not actually be able to answer that, because the textbook we currently use in general chem, I don't think speaks directly to this topic. A textbook that we used a year or two ago, I forget, maybe 2 years now, actually broached this topic. Have any of you ever heard of the term activity? Or I've heard of activity coefficients. That you've heard of? Okay, so where that's related to is the following. If we expect something to fully dissociate, that means its ions pull apart from each other and have nothing else to do with each other. But what happens when we start getting really concentrated solutions? It may be that there are so many ions in solution that they're not exactly put together to make a compound. But remember that in solution, we have a solvent that often we don't talk about very much. And particularly where water is a solvent, water forms these things called water or solvent cages. In other words, you'll have, like an onion, a layer of water molecules around the center, and then another layer of water molecules around that, and another layer of water molecules around that. And for ions to transport through solution, they have to be able to break through those cages, which are not like iron bars. It is just water molecules, so things can slip through, but things can get surrounded at the same time. What if somehow a plus and a minus ion both get trapped in the same solvation sphere? Well, then they're dissociated, but they act like they're one particle in a way. Which, if you think back to colligative properties, back to Chem 1A, we were dealing with boiling point elevation, freezing point depression. We had that delta T is equal to K times I times N expression. Yeah. The freezing point depression is dependent on the molality of the solution, the constant associated with the solvent itself, and then the ionization constant, which tells you how much is something going to dissociate. Well, for something like HCl, you'd expect that number to be 2, because you put in 1 HCl and you expect to get H plus and Cl minus out. But what I'm telling you is if you have a concentrated enough solution, that doesn't happen. That means the effective concentration of HCl in solution is lower than the calculated concentration in solution. These activity values are associated with something known as chemical potential, which is a measure of energy. Since equilibrium is also a measure of energy, we use these chemical potentials to make an equilibrium constant. However, if you make certain simplifications, which we do, we end up using concentrations, not activity coefficients, in equilibrium constants. So that's why for all of time, when you see an equilibrium constant, you've been putting concentrations in. But it's actually, quite technically, wrong. Because the real concentration that exists in solution is not necessarily the way that you prepared it because of this activity effect. And one of those manifestations of activity is the formation of ion pairs, which in this case would mean the H plus that you think you have available, you don't, which means the pH is a little higher than what you would calculate.
The way you're all looking at me, you haven't heard any of this before, have you? Talked about in Chem 1B a little bit. This sounds like I just walked out of a Chem 1B class, doesn't it? But you need to know this, those of you that might be dealing with a field that depends on acid-base measurements for some of its observations, because this has an effect on what you're going to see. And you have to take it into account or you just get your answers wrong. So when solutions are highly concentrated, interactions between solute particles can cause a solution to have behavior that deviates from ideal. And that's quantified by this thing known as activity. We're not actually going to be doing anything with activity from this point onwards. But if we're doing a review of acid-based chemistry anticipating your future, you just need to know such a thing exists. Now, to get a little bit back more on track then, let's talk about weak acids. Which are acids that spontaneously only dissociate a very small amount. And acetic acid is the most common example of a weak acid that we use both in general and organic chemistry. So, how about this? Given a 1.0 molar solution of acetic acid and ignoring activity, predict the pH of the solution.
How do we solve this problem? Or what information will we need to solve this problem? I think I heard someone say it.
Ice.
Ice is the way to solve it, and we need the Ka value.
So Ka for acetic acid is 1.76 times 10 to the negative 5, which means its pKa is 4.76.
Quite coincidentally, 4.76 is the pKb of ammonia. So if you can remember one, you can get the other. If and when any of you ever find yourself in the situation of showing someone how to solve an ice problem, which I'm sure happens every day. Now, what is this ice problem?
Well, it's short for initial change equilibrium or initial change end. Which means we look at a process, we identify what compounds we need to worry about as far as what are their concentrations.
We try to figure out what those concentrations are at the start of whatever process we're trying to calculate. We then determine how will those concentrations change. We put together to get an expression for what we think is really going to exist in solution. And since this is a process that's governed by an equilibrium constant, we then throw it back in the equilibrium constant and solve. So let me write out, or we have up above what the dissociation is here for acetic acid.
So to abbreviate, there's HA, the acid itself, H plus that's generated, and A minus that's generated as well.
So based on the information given to this problem, what would be the initial concentration of HA?
One, because you're given a one molar solution. And yes, of course it's going to dissociate,
but that's the reason that we set the problem up the way we are. We first state what's in the solution the moment that the solution is formed and before any kind of equilibrium is established. At that point, what's going to be the H plus concentration?
Goodness, 10 to the negative 7.
Right? Because there's the auto-ionization of water. Now, yes, we always call this 0 for this kind of problem because in 1A, we don't work problems where you have very dilute solutions of weak acids. But if you had such things, then the auto-ionization of water becomes competitive and you have to worry about it.
But since we have a concentrated solution of acetic acid,
We'll ignore it and call it zero. Regardless of what that concentration is, what would A minus initially, before the solution has a chance to do anything, what would it be? Zero. But now, of course, as soon as we throw acetic acid into water, some of it dissociates. So if it dissociates, that means it goes down in quantity, so we can represent that by negative x. Since this is a one-to-one-to-one stoichiometric correspondence between HA and the H plus and A minus produced, they'll each go up by that same quantity, x. Which means we get final concentrations of 1 minus x, x, x. We have the Ka, which as a reminder is H plus times A minus over HA, which means we get 1.76 times 10 negative 5 is equal to x times x over 1 minus x, which means we're going to have to solve a quadratic. Or will we? Why not? So we look at what our likely solution is going to be. X is going to end up being very tiny compared to the number 1. Whenever we multiply by x, we're not allowed just to drop that out and say, oh, x doesn't matter. Because if we did that, we'd say, oh, 0 times 0 over 1 minus 0 is equal to something not 0. But of course, that doesn't make any logical sense. But if x is equal to 0.0000001, then that, if we took 1 minus that value, we'd get 0.99999999. So, which is equal to 1, really. And within the limits of whatever instrumentation you probably use to measure these things. So, if x is much less than 1, it is allowable to ignore it, to simplify it, in other words.
It's a very big if, though. Because it doesn't always happen.
And your book, your general chem book, would give you some guidelines, which it's been long enough since I taught this little aspect formally. I know that there's one that goes something along the lines of, if you take the ratio of Ka and the concentration of acid, and if it's 100 or more, then you can ignore it. Or if there's this that you compare to that, and it's 10, or there's some other comparisons you can make. Well, there's a 5% tolerance, which that manifests with in these, by having these certain ratios, which we all pull up in a general chem text, we can figure out what that was. But let's just solve this, making the simplification, and demonstrate to ourselves, just on a numerical basis, that in this case it's acceptable.
Because if I do get rid of that minus x, then I get x squared is equal to 1.76 times 10 to negative 5, which means x is some number, 4.19 times 10 to negative 3. That's equal to the H plus concentration. So that leads us to the pH being 2.38. Backing up one small step, we see that x is something times 10 to the negative 3, less than 1% the value of the number 1. So if we didn't simplify, we would have been off by maybe less than 1%, which for most purposes, that's acceptable deviation, and so that's why we're able to make the simplification. Part of the reason I'm showing you this is to remind you what an ice problem is. Part of the reason I'm showing you this is to talk about these simplifications, because as I said in my little preamble to all of this, we need to find out when does the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation not work. And it's related to these kinds of issues. But judging the, just, I'm taken aback by this stunning energy that's coming at me right now. The interest you all are showing this topic is deafening, and so I'm just going to continue on to the next example, shall I?
to be honest,
I am impressed that as many of you are here as you are. Because if you heard from your other classmates that was just lecture, and how many of you didn't sleep last night, and you're still here even after the exam, commendable. There's no extra credit, but it's commendable.
Extra credit? What?
Appreciation credit.
Appreciation credit?
I appreciate you. Do I get some credit for that? So,
here's our next problem
that we're not going to solve, but I want you to think about this because this is another typical situation. Given a one molar solution of acetic acid, let's say we have 1 liter of that one molar solution. If somehow we were to introduce half a mole of sodium hydroxide in solid form, somehow without changing the volume, what would be the pH of the solution? And actually, this time, I'm going to ask that again a little bit more slowly. If I have 1 liter of a 1 molar acetic acid solution, if I were to put in half a mole of sodium hydroxide, somehow maintaining that 1 liter of volume, what would be the pH of the solution? In the truly exceptionally chemically gifted in here, we'll get the answer like that. Because it requires no math.
Seven.
Good guess, but no. The answer is 4.76. Because I just described the half equivalence point.
But the volume is the same.
Right? I know the volume is the same. So if you get rid of half a moles of your acid because you've added that amount of base, well, then you're left with half of the original acid, half of it is its conjugate. When you have the acid and its conjugate equal in proportion, that's the half equivalence point, which we're going to show is the point when the pKa is equal to the pH. Now let me back up and show you what I really was trying to show by this question, though. If we're given a neutralization example, then the mistake that many people make is to write down acid plus hydroxide makes salt and water. If you're given a Ka, that is for the dissociation of the acid, and it has nothing to do with the neutralization equation. But people try to take the Ka's, turn them into some kind of equilibrium constant, and solve simultaneously for the acid, the hydroxide, whatever else gets formed. Why is hydroxide such an excellent base for these kinds of problems? Not in terms of chemical reactivity. Why does it work out really well in terms of simplifying the problem that you have to work? It will make water, right? Once you make water, it disappears from any of the equations that we're dealing with, correct? Because we're dealing with equilibrium constants, if we're working in aqueous solutions and we make water, water no longer ends up in that equilibrium constant. So here's what we do. We take the original acid, we say, oh, when hydroxide reacts with it, it's going to make water. So simply subtract the number of moles of base from the number of moles of acid, and you've got the acid that's left. Of course, once you do that, you're making some conjugate. And so the number of moles of base, you add to the conjugate because it's going to be produced from the acid. It then turns back into a standard ice problem, which you can then solve. Since that truly had a phenomenal impact, let me now give you the end result. The same question. It's true, right? You're just not used to your instructors giving the running commentary that you all are texting and tweeting and blogging. He's really boring today, right? I'm just turning it back around. He's lecturing after the exam. I want to die. That's your next picture online. A picture of that baby looking intently. Instead of Allosaurus glucose mannose, it says, and then he gave a lecture after the exam. So, let's say that we had a solution of 0.5 molar acetic acid and 0.5 molar sodium acetate. how would we calculate the pH of this solution? Well, we do exactly the same way we did before. We do it as an ice problem. Let me ask you this question that we're going to show the answer to in a second. Will the concentrations of acetic acid and sodium acetate be 0.5 molar after equilibrium? In other words, if I prepared by taking pure acetic acid, pure sodium acetate, put them both into a liter of solution, half a mole of each, will the solution actually exist this way?
No,
it won't, because there's a specific equilibrium between its acid and base form. If you put some arbitrary concentrations of the two together, they're going to shift a little bit one way or another in order to make equilibrium. If it shifts a lot, then we are not able to make any simplifications in our calculations. If it shifts hardly at all, then we're going to see we can make some simplifications in our calculations. It's exactly the situation which determines, do we use the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation or not? And let's see why and how.
First, let's solve the problem doing ice, doing the formal method. So we have HA again representing the acetic acid. It's going to associate to make H+. We'll have A- as the conjugate.
What will be the initial concentration of the acid?
0.5.
Because remember, when we set these problems up, even though we know it's wrong, we start with what we're given and see how will the equilibrium shift to get us to the right answer.
What will the initial concentration of the base be? Also 0.5. What will the initial concentration of acid be?
Effectively.
Zero. I'll put it in quotation marks to show that I'm indicating, yeah, it's not zero, but it's close enough that we can ignore it.
Here's another way to spin this next idea. If this is zero, then the only thing possible is for its value to go up. If we say it's zero, and we say that equilibrium will occur when it can, well, equilibrium wants to make at least a little H+. So if we say we have zero H+, some H+ gets generated no matter what.
Which, if we have established that, that means that we're going to use, if X's are increased, negative X to show how much of the acid is associated to make that H+, which will at the same time make A-. So we end up with 0.5 minus X, X, and 0.5 plus X as our end values. To solve, we would put in an equilibrium expression. And now we're in the same kind of situation where we would have to otherwise solve a quadratic.
Again, if X was really small compared to 0.5, we could simplify, couldn't we? So if X is much, much less than 0.5, then 0.5 minus X equals 0.5 itself.
Well, we could do that for both the numerator and denominator. Why not?
Because if X is small enough to be ignored for one, it's automatically small enough to be ignored for the other one.
But that means that we get Ka is equal to 1.76 to negative fifth is equal to X times
0.5 divided by 0.5,
which means it's X, which is our H plus concentration. And what that means is the pKa is
roughly equal to the pH at that point. But this expression is only true if the concentrations of the acid and its conjugate shift only slightly once the buffer solution is prepared. Because this is a nearly ideal buffer solution. Can't remember if it's 0.1 molar that people prefer to make, but it's equal proportions, K of an acid in its conjugate.
So let me put a star here and say this simplification only is valid if the concentrations of an acid and its conjugate do not shift substantially once the solution is prepared.
So where do we go next? Well, let's generalize this approach. Because if you notice, by making that simplification, what we did is we stuck in the concentration for the acid in its appropriate place. We stuck the concentration of the base in the appropriate place. Again, not making the adjustment for equilibrium. Well, again, let's generalize that process.
We do that by taking the Ka expression. And let's rewrite it. Let's take the negative base 10 log of both sides of this expression. Well, negative base 10 log of Ka is pKa. The log of a product is the sum of the individual logs. So we can expand the right-hand side to be negative base 10 log of H plus concentration minus the, or sorry, plus the negative base 10 log concentration of A minus divided by HA.
Okay, simplifying a little further, negative base 10 log of H plus is pH.
So we get pKa is equal to pH minus the base 10 log of the ratio of A minus's concentration versus HA. Rewriting that, we get pH is equal to pKa plus the base 10 log of A minus over HA, which that is then the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. You could also say that pH is pKa minus the log of HA over A minus.
Because if you invert a fraction, it's the negative of its log. And this equation, though, only works if you can make exactly the type of simplification that we made just up above.
So one more time, we did a very special case
of an ideal buffer solution where an acid has its same concentration as a conjugate. But if you look at what the result was, we canceled out the minus x and plus x. And that would have been the adjustments to these initial concentrations. If we say that the initial concentrations won't shift much, then we generalize this way to solve the problem and we put it into the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation. Why? Because if you simply know the concentration of the conjugates, you can get the pH, again, if those concentrations don't shift. So in real life, you would get a problem like this. Given a maximum of 100 grams of sodium carbonate and sodium bicarbonate, and if you had to prepare 1 liter, or let's say 10 liters of solution that had pH, biological pH, so 7.2, how would you do it? And what you would do is you'd say, okay, you would look up whatever the pKa of hydrogen carbonate is. You would look up the pH you want, 7.2. You'd solve for the ratio of the concentrations. You would get that ratio of concentrations, convert those into moles, convert those into grams, figure out how much of each of the reagents you would use, and then discuss how you would prepare the solution. Because remember, if we're talking about molarity, you add everything together and fill up to the volume mark, not add that volume of liquid. Type of problem you'll work in your biochem class when you get to buffers. And you'll use this equation to do that. Now that is the first two-thirds of our review. Let's take a five-minute break, and we'll come back to talk about titration. Because we've reached our first goal, the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation.
Titration! Yay!
So, let's talk about the type of titration you did back in Chem 1A. Titrating acetic acid with sodium hydroxide.
That's exactly where we're going to go first. M1V1 equals M2V2. Because before we get into how do we determine when a titration is complete, how do we process that information as far as the acid strength? Because remember, that's what we're going for in this discussion, is how can we use titration to determine the strength of these different amino acids. There is, of course, the stoichiometric aspect, which that's what you tackled in 1A, and that's where this M1V1 comes from. So, actually, if we're doing a titration, I'll just write it as a forward-only reaction. And since this is, in fact, a standard Arrhenius acid-base titration, this follows the normal pattern of acid plus base makes salt plus water. And we're going to come back and talk more about this term later on, but the point of doing a titration is you want to get to the point where this is not a limiting reaction. In other words, you want to have exactly the same number of moles of acid reacting with the number of moles of base, which is known as the equivalence point. So at the equivalence point, again, we're going to revisit what that term means. At the equivalence point, the moles of acid is equal to the number of moles of base.
But we're not dealing with solids, we're dealing with solutions. And yes, if we take molarity and multiply it by volume, that gives us moles. Because remember that molarity is mole solute over liter solution. We're measuring these whole bits of solution when we're titrating, so the units cancel and gives us moles.
But we'll substitute that. Molarity of the acid times the volume of the acid is equal to the molarity of the base times the volume of the base.
Now, out of these four variables, we're able to measure or calculate
three of them. The molarity of the acid, if this was
a titration of a weak acid, is, of course, the unknown quantity. And then you have the volume of acetic acid, volume of sodium hydroxide that you use, that you would measure.
And then the molarity of the base, which in certain titrations, maybe would just be calculating it. But if this was like exactly the titration we did back in Chem 1A, we would instead standardize.
Which means before using the base, we would turn around and titrate the base with yet another acid. The one which would itself be the true reference compound, known as the primary standard. In Chem 1A, we used KHP as that primary standard because it was although in dicarboxylic acid, because remember, we now know what phthalic acid is from the thalamide synthesis, that phthalic acid is the P in KHP. KHP means out of the two carboxylic acids, one's already been deprotonated, so you only have one proton left, which makes it chemically very similar then to acetic acid, which is the compound we want to try to determine the concentration of. Since KHP can be measured out very accurately and precisely as far as it's a solid, so it's easy to measure, and if we were to handle it correctly, we could make sure that it does not absorb water, We can then use a volumetric flask, which could have four significant figures in its volume measurement, to make a solution that would have four significant figures in it for this reference KHP solution, which then you react with the sodium hydroxide, so you can get sodium hydroxide's concentration, which you then use here to get acetic acid's concentration. So that's the stoichiometric side of things. But now let's go back and talk about performing the titration and talk about how does that get us eventually to acid strength. So physically, titration setup is often something like this, where you have your acid burette, you have your base burette, you add a certain quantity of the unknown acid and water into a reaction flask. Does it matter how much water we add in principle? No, because we're not, again, trying to determine pH of the solution during a titration. We could measure pH, but the idea is that you're looking for the equivalence point. Equivalence point being when moles of acid equals moles of base, which has nothing to do with water. So as far as the results of a titration, whatever water you add to the solution at this point shouldn't matter. But what other thing do we need to add into the solution? The indicator. And what indicator would be chosen for this kind of process? Starts with a P. Phenolphthalein. Why is phenolphthalein chosen for the titration of acetic acid and sodium hydroxide? Colors. And what changes color? It changes color around the same pH we expect once the titration is completed. When this is done, will the solution be neutral? Well, I heard some yeses. Of course it will not be neutral. And we'll get into why momentarily. If it's not neutral, then we need to make sure that whatever indicator we use changes its color at that same pH point, or else we're going to stop the titration at the wrong time. So, you might recall, if you were in Chem 1B, an experiment you did where you took an indicator and you put it into solutions of different pH. Do we all remember that at all? Who took Chem 1B here? With not with me, just who took Chem 1B here, DeAnza? So you had one of those spectrophotometer experiments where you made 14 solutions. They were different colors of green, blue, and yellow. And it was a indicator lab, and you were trying to find out the strength of an indicator. A non-zero number of you were in that 1B class of mine. So I'll remind us that part of the reason, or part of the point of that lab was that an indicator tends to change its color also at its own half equivalence point. In other words, if you have an indicator that has a base form, an acid form, and you put exactly the equal proportion of the two in solution, then if you end up with more base or acid, that means it's going to flip colors one way or the other. So within about one pH unit of the pKa of an indicator is the range within which an indicator is useful, and so you therefore want to make sure that you match your pKa of the indicator to the anticipated pH of the solution at the end point.
So an indicator is chosen so that the pKa of that indicator matches the anticipated pH of the titration mixture at the equivalence point. Now let me bring up a couple of terms that would help explain why we care about this. Because I've already defined for you what the equivalence point of a titration is. What is the equivalence point? It's when the moles of acid equals moles of base. But there's this other thing called the end point. What is the end point? It's the place where indicator changes color, which two comments on that. If you didn't choose your indicator properly, then it may change colors, but not at the time where you actually have equal moles. Even if you did choose it properly, are the human eyes the best possible judge of a change in color? Even if they were somehow, what if you were just barely shy of being at the end point? And you were about to add a drop, but it turns out you only need half a drop of solution to get to the end point. Are you going to be able to anticipate that and know to divide a drop in half somehow? No. So the point is, the end point is the visual clue that a titration is completed. If properly done, it will be nearly identical to the end point, but not necessarily so. So they're two distinct concepts. So the end point is the visual indication that a titration is complete. Meaning a color change. And we saw these kinds of color changes in this acid-base titration we did in 1A. We saw color changes when we did redox titration in Chem 1A with the triiodide and the sodium thiosulfate. And then when you did your complexometric titration with EDTA back in Chem 1C. Also a color change there. But if we wanted to do it more accurately, we would use a pH meter in these acid-base cases because there's a particular point we can find on that graph that we can ascribe to being the equivalence point. Now, before we can get there, though, we need to talk about a couple of things. Because I asked earlier that once we titrate acetic acid with sodium hydroxide, would we end up with a neutral solution? The answer to that is no. And so I want to cover these terms. What does neutral mean? How do we know when something is neutral? Has nothing to do with acids and bases. What is the definition of neutral? Singularly fundamental concept in acid-base chemistry. You need to be able to give this definition. That is correct. Because we started off this review with the autoionization of water. I said in neutral water, you'll have equal proportions of H plus and OH generated. Therefore, the definition of neutral is H plus concentration equals OH concentration. You all get a virtual gold star, which has a value of 0 extra credit points. For the fact it didn't say pH 7. Because at least you remember that from the beginning part of the lecture, that no, pH 7 doesn't mean neutral. pH 7 means H plus concentration is 1.0 times 10 to the negative 7. This is the correct definition. Now, what's neutralized? The acid and base have the same moles. That now is the correct definition. And by acid, you cannot mean H+.
And by base, you cannot mean OH-.
Why?
Why is one of these definitions focused on H plus and OH minus, and another one is focused on the acids and bases themselves? Why are these two different concepts? Okay, let's say that we limit our discussion to Arrhenius bases. So the Ka of acetic acid, if we round it, is 1.0 times 10 to the negative 5. Let's make it an even simpler number. Let's round too far up. Let's call it 1.0 times 10 to the negative 4. Then what would be the percentage of acetic acid that should dissociate in solution, roughly? Square root of 10 to the negative 4 is 10 to the negative 2, which is 0.01, which means 1%. Right? So if 1% of acetic acid dissociates all by itself, that means given 1 mole of acetic acid, you have 0.01 moles of H+. I'll say it again. Given 1.0 moles of acetic acid, you get 0.01 moles H+. So right here, H plus is not the same as moles of acid, and so neutral is not the same thing as neutralized. Another way to say it is this. If I have an acid and a base react with each other, this acid makes some H plus. This base makes some OH minus. If they don't produce the same amount because they're not the same acid-base strengths, then you get an imbalance in how much H plus and OH minus are produced. So, for example, when you take acetic acid, which is a weak acid, and you force it to dissociate, then imagine if we just took sodium acetate, the conjugate by itself, and threw it into water. It wants to reestablish equilibrium with acetic acid. But there is no acetic acid, so it makes it by reacting with water. Acetate reacts with water, and you make hydroxide, which means you make a basic solution, even though all you had was sodium acetate. Since sodium acetate is the product of neutralization of a weak acid and a strong base, that means a weak acid plus a strong base makes a strongly basic solution, because the strong beats out the weak. Right? Little Nietzschean chemistry here, I guess. But let me see how I wrote this the other day. If a weak acid or base is used in titration, then the number of moles of H plus, or if we're talking about a base, OH minus, that are effectively generated will be less than the number of the moles of the acid or base itself. And let me add a little clarification that when I say how much H plus and OH minus is produced by spontaneous dissociation. And the effect that this has is that neutral, which is when H plus and OH minus are equal, may not happen just because you do a neutralization. So it means it's not the same thing as saying neutralized. Now, along with that, I was talking about taking something like acetic acid, which is a weak acid, and then reacting it with sodium hydroxide, which is a strong base.
And you end up making a salt that is basic.
Why? Because once acetic acid has been totally neutralized by the sodium hydroxide, a salt is produced that tries to reestablish equilibrium with its parent acid. So again, once we force this titration to the end, we force it out of equilibrium. So it tries to establish an equilibrium. To do this, the acetate reacts with water, which produces hydroxide, which produces a basic solution. So again, weak acid, strong base wins, solution is basic. So again, knowing this, we could go off and do a calculation to figure out what should the pH be to then know the correct indicator to use.
Or, this is the last bit for today, doing it the pH method. In other words, start off with an acid, which means we're going to be closer to pH 0. We look at how the pH changes as we add sodium hydroxide, which because in this example it is the compound being used to quantify something about the acetic acid, we refer to sodium hydroxide as the titrant.
So you might recall
that a curve will look something like this.
Now, the shape of this curve does depend on, do you have a strong acid and a strong base? Or do you have a strong acid, weak base? Or do we have, like this case, a weak acid, strong base? Do you have two weak acids and bases? Are either of them polyprotic? So the curve can have different forms. We're just going to take this one case of weak acid, strong base.
Now, since we're talking about acetic acid and sodium hydroxide, the steepest part of the curve here, which I'm going to tell you ahead of time, is the equivalence point, is going to happen above pH 7, weak acid, strong base.
But let's try to understand a little bit about the shape of this curve. And so let's go back again to some of these real rough figures of pH of hydrochloric acid solutions. Because let's pretend that we were titrating hydrochloric acid instead of sodium hydroxide. We'll still see a titration curve. Here's kind of the point. .1, .01, .001, .0001 molar hydrochloric acid is going to produce
approximately pH 1, pH 2, pH 3, and pH 4. So as we go from one of these concentrations to the next, we're just going by one pH unit at a time. How much of the original acid would need to be destroyed to go from pH 1 to pH 2 for this situation? 90%, right? From the start to pH 3, though,
what would that percentage be?
99%. But that means to go from pH 1 to pH 2,
we had to get rid of 90% of it. It only required an additional 9%
to get to the next pH unit. We can do a similar comparison between pHs 1 and 4. That to get to that point, you have to get rid of 99.9% of it. But that means from where you just came, pH 3, there's a change of only 0.9%
compared to the original quantity.
So that means if we started out with this pH 1 solution,
as we're adding sodium hydroxide, after this little initial part of the curve that we're not going to discuss today, the pH kind of plateaus out. You're adding hydroxide and antihydroxide, and it slowly changes until you've added 90% of the hydroxide you need, and you've gone up one pH unit. Then you go just the next 9%, one-tenth the distance you did before, and it's gone up another pH unit. And then you go another one-tenth of that distance, and then another one-tenth, and you get to where your volume's hardly changing, but the pH skyrockets. Now, all I've done is describe to you what happens with a log graph. When you graph things on a log scale, it makes them not linearly proportional. It is why, though, we end up with this huge slope that turns out that occurs at the equivalence point.
From that, we could get the volume of the equivalence point. We then can determine where we have half the volume, because then that would be the half equivalence point.
Which at the half equivalence point
that's exactly where the concentration of its acid is supposedly equal to its conjugate base concentration. Which we already solved the problem earlier in exactly that case.
We had the half molar acetic acid and half molar sodium acetate together in solution. Well, when you have equal amounts of the acid and its conjugate, then that's exactly when the pH equals the pKa. So you do a titration. You find the volume needed to get to equivalence. You then find half that volume, look up the pH at that point, and that is the pKa, which was the point of reviewing what a titration was, to know how could we get the pKa of an acid. Through titration. Questions?